This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
How Trump gets it done. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your Valentine's Day weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
With the next Republican primary taking place a week from now in South Carolina, we'll explore the unusual campaign of businessman Donald Trump.
On the medical front, the phrase you thought you'd never hear uttered by a hospital.
New trend in the fitness world, 30-day challenges. We'll explain what they are and how they work.
And what the world will look like when humans are no longer driving their cars.
If you remove humans completely from the equation, then that eliminates 93% of accidents. You don't have to worry about drunk drivers anymore, and you don't have to worry about the people around you just being stupid or making stupid decisions.
Erin Biba at Newsweek on what autonomous cars will mean for society. Her report in about 25 minutes. Exactly how did billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump piece together a presidential campaign with so much momentum? Kevin Robillard at Politico says it may look like Mr. Trump is making it up as he goes at times, but this run has been planned for years. Kevin, what'd you dig up?
You know, as much as people think Trump sort of makes these things up as he goes along, he puts a little bit more thought into it than anyone expected. And sort of, you know, way back in 2013 originally was when he started planning this. And, you know, he told a group of New York political consultants, you know, I'll be able to run for president basically using the media. And that's really what he's done. He hasn't been done much paid advertising. He's relied on earned media, which is not a strategy political consultants traditionally recommend. But Trump, you know, knew he knew how to manipulate the media, and that's what he's basically done.
That group wanted him to run for governor, right? Wasn't that what that initial meeting was about in 2013?
Yeah, it was sort of GOP county chairman, assemblymen, sort of rank-and-file Republican officials in New York State who wanted him to run for governor. You know, New York Republicans traditionally, they haven't done well recently at the statewide level, so they were sort of looking for someone they thought might have some appeal there, and they came to Trump, and he said, you know, I have slightly larger ambitions.
and in the end, he almost didn't do it, right? He got cold feet toward announcing time?
Yeah, he did. He was, right before his announcement, he was in Scotland opening up sort of a new clubhouse for one of the golf courses he owns there, called his campaign manager, said he wasn't sure he wanted to do it, was, you know, getting cold feet, was, you know, perhaps a little bit worried about some of the things that did happen. He was, you know, sounded like he was worried a little bit about his brand, worried about maybe not being able to do The Apprentice anymore, which is, you know, something that I think Trump clearly enjoyed doing. So there was a lot of debate over when Trump would do things. There was some thought that Trump actually would be entering the election around this time. That was something his campaign manager had proposed to him, that he would enter the election sort of maybe even after Iowa, with the idea being that he could sort of somehow emerge as a savior, which is what Richard Nixon did, you know, back in 1968. That was the idea, that he would sort of replicate that. But Trump said, no, I want to get out there during the summer where there's this big sort of gap in the media and take advantage and fill that news gap when all these other candidates are trying to sort of stay, you know, under the media's radar, which was something a lot of these candidates had embraced. You know, Marco Rubio, his campaign regularly talked about how he didn't want to get too high before the primaries really started voting. So, you know, that was, Trump saw that void and ran into it.
We're speaking with Kevin Robillard. He's campaign reporter at Politico, talking about their piece entitled How Trump Did It. Also, this whole idea of no scripts, right? Explain explain announcement day and how that went down when he went on forever, right, with no script or teleprompter whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, Trump basically, you know, on that, you know, he said consistently he doesn't work with scripts. Apparently on the set of The Apprentice, he didn't work with scripts either. But if you go back to that original announcement speech where he sort of came down that escalator, as everybody remembered, and, you know, said, you know, basically said that Mexico was sending rapists to the United States. You know, he was originally supposed to stop speaking about 30 minutes before he did. The House speakers began playing him off once he was done with what his sort of scripted original speech was, and he just kept going and going and going. And basically, he's used that same off-the-cuff speaking style ever since. He basically writes down sort of a few ideas of what he wants to emphasize on a little note card or a piece of paper before he goes on. He puts it on the lectern to, you know, remind him of what he wants to talk about. And then he almost, and, you know, if you watch, he almost does, like, free association. It's, you know, one thought just leads to the next. Sometimes that leads him to some pretty odd places, but it's definitely part of his appeal, the fact that he's not planning out every last thing that he says the way, you know, a Ted Cruz, who clearly has a very, you know, practiced routine, or Marco Rubio has sort of a practiced routine. Mm-hmm. Trump does not, and I think that's part of his appeal.
Wow. So what did he mean by using the power of mass audience?
So, yeah, he always thought that he would be able to ignore a lot of the rules for how you win a state like Iowa. The rules for how you win a state like Iowa is that you do what Rick Santorum, who won Iowa in 2012, did. You know, you go to all these counties, you try to compete, you know, what's called the full Grassley, named after Iowa's senator, who goes to all of Iowa's 99 counties every year.
Yeah.
The idea is you have to do something like that. You have to compete. You know, go to all of these small towns, campaign in sort of the stereotypical place is a pizza ranch, which is a big sort of pizza chain in the state of Iowa, and hold these small events where, you know, maybe only 10 or 15 voters might show up. That's not something that I think appeals to Donald Trump very much, and he said he wasn't going to do it. And you've seen Trump sort of bypass that. You know, Trump has been holding huge rallies wherever he can, often in states that aren't necessarily important to the early primary process. You know, he held one in Lowell, Massachusetts. He's gone to Mississippi and Arizona multiple times, into Alabama. And these aren't places that vote particularly early. And even then, he's not doing sort of the standard, you know, show up at a person's house in New Hampshire either. He's doing these big events because that's what he does best, and that's what gets the media coverage. And he uses that media coverage to drive and control what happens during the nominating process.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin Robillard at Politico. The South Carolina primary is the next one up. It is February 20th, next Saturday. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Your employees want to do their best work. Give them the power to do it with new high-performance Dell systems like the XPS 13, featuring the world's first virtually borderless Infinity Edge display. Outfitted with the latest Intel Core processors, your team can reduce downtime by 50%. And boost productivity with 4 times their performance. Make your work beautiful again at Dell.com/business.
I'm sorry, so sorry, that I was such a fool.
Here's a 180 taking place in the medical community. Hospitals coughing up two little words you'd never thought you'd hear. I'm sorry. Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau says when things go wrong, communication and resolution programs help patients get an apology, an explanation, and sometimes monetary compensation. Laura, what's up?
Many years ago, they came up with the idea, some kind of pioneering big academic medical centers, that if they went to patients, and there are actually studies that show this works, if you've done something to harm a patient, whether intentionally or unintentionally, or there's been negligence, or some doctor has messed up, or a nurse has done something wrong, the old way was to clam up, get the risk managers involved, deny everything, and, you know, get all the lawyers involved. And what they have found is that many times what patients simply want is to be apologized to. They want an explanation of what happened, and they want, you know, some kind of compensation. So they tried this, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, some of these big centers, but it didn't really catch on because everybody, the risk managers were too scared to do this. They didn't want to offer any money unless they thought that they were going to get sued. And doctors were terrified to apologize because they thought it could be used against them in a malpractice suit.
Right. Okay, so fast forward to today. What's happening? Are we revisiting this a little bit?
Well, it's a whole kind of evolution of all of this. And what they've done is they've come up with a couple of things have changed. First of all, if you know a little bit about the malpractice world, a lot of states now have caps on malpractice claims, so you can't go and sue for $20 million. You maybe can sue for $250,000. There are apology laws around the states that say a doctor can apologize without it being held against him as if he's done something, you know, to be sued for. And also, there is growing pressure. You know, you've heard all these reports about medical error, all these calls for transparency. Part of the Affordable Care Act is looking for ways to do better when things go wrong. Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals, wants them to investigate and be transparent about errors. So it's kind of a groundswell of events that have all of a sudden made people in the hospital world say, we're going to be better off if we do this. And then there's the data which says, after years of comparing what it, you know, malpractice costs used to be, places like Stanford University, Stanford Hospital, they have a big healthcare system out there. They have found that over the time that they've been doing this, over a decade, the malpractice costs and the number of suits actually drop pretty dramatically. People don't sue as much. And when they do offer compensation, it isn't these gigantic amounts.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. Her piece is called Hospitals Find a Way to Say I'm Sorry. Does this apply to all events in a hospital, from the say, what would be considered minor to the very serious?
Well, yes. You know, they actually have a severity scale, and it's basically, it goes from, you can imagine, the most severe thing is death, and then it goes all the way down to something almost happened, but it didn't. And they're supposed to also report on near-miss events, like we brought the wrong blood to this patient. Fortunately, the patient had the right blood type. Or the nurse was about to administer the wrong dose of medication, but she caught it in time. So they want to know everything. The idea is everything that happens, you have some kind of learning from as a hospital, which is you got to be really careful to do the triple check with the patient. This brings home the lesson that we do this right dose, right patient, right time check every single time. You know, you might go to the hospital and you've talked to the person four times and they'd say, could you tell us your name and birth date? And you might find that annoying, but that's a safety check. So you want to make sure that they're going through safety checks at all stages of the experience. And so the severity scale helps them determine, you know, in some cases, you know, in Stanford, for example, in some cases they'll say, you know what, we did not intend this to happen. And by the way, legally, the person probably doesn't have a lawsuit. But we are going to give them, and it might be up to $5,000. They've had extra expenses to come and come back to the hospital and have it dealt with. Sometimes they'll waive a bill. They'll do things, again, they keep saying we want to make the patient whole.
Thanks, Laura. Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. There's a plan B for you if your New Year's resolution to get fit has already fallen apart. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's called the 30-Day Fitness Challenge. Whether it's running, cycling, or yoga, such challenges are all the rage. With more on the story, Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, first of all, where did this concept originate?
Well, that's a great question. I'm not sure anybody knows. One place it definitely got more popular and got more traction was in a TED Talk given by Google software engineer Matt Cutts. That was in 2011. He had already been doing his own self-styled 30-day challenges for a few years. And that talk went viral. About 7 million people have watched it. And it, in fact, spawned some other 30-day challenges since then.
What makes the 30-day exercise challenge different from, say, a New Year's resolution?
I think a lot of people are familiar with the pattern of New Year's resolutions. We get all excited to make a big change. We set a really lofty goal. And then according to some data, our resolve starts to weaken around the third week in January or the first week in February. So I think the duration of New Year's resolutions tend to be a little bit ambitious. 30-day challenges are a little bit more manageable and, you know, long enough to feel like you accomplished something, but not so long to feel like they're unreachable.
Rachel, where are they coming from? Is this like a gym promoting such an exercise program or a studio or something else?
They're really coming from everywhere. There are some yoga studios and gyms that promote 30-day challenges, partly in an effort to get people to come in and pay them for their services, of course, but there have been challenges that have circulated on the internet and sort of graphic form on Facebook. More recently, apps are becoming really popular. The number of 30-day challenge apps has just exploded in the last 2 years. There's now more than 200 on the Apple operating system alone. And so people really are gravitating toward these. The apps themselves are very short. One developer I talked to said that people who use his apps like the Ab Challenge spend no more than 4 minutes at a time on average each day. So they really are very manageable.
You talked a minute ago about making money. How are the gyms making money off of this?
Well, certainly if you're challenging someone to come in and do something every day, it means that people are coming in and paying, right? There's a chain of yoga studios, a Bikram chain in Manhattan, that offers a 30-day challenge for $39, which is a great deal because their normal monthly rate is about $145, including towel service. And what they're hoping is that someone will become so energized by this routine that they'll come back the next month and pay full fare and keep coming back month after month. And there is some evidence that you know, doing something with great frequency can help establish a habit.
Is there any kind of evidence that the apps are working in the same way, that people are sticking with it and then continuing on?
Well, it's interesting. The developer I talked to shared some data that really is sort of two-pronged. On the one hand, for instance, this ab challenge, he said only about 17% of the people who started it on day one were also doing it on day 30. So that's not a great conversion rate. But he said that the people who do these apps tend to come back over and over again. So the people who get through them, either they're very dedicated to begin with or they find them so satisfying that they come back and do them again and again.
Rachel, I would imagine that someone who's a total non-exerciser could get a little burned out by jumping in too quickly.
Absolutely. In fact, some of the challenges floating around the internet have gotten some criticism for being too ambitious, particularly for people who maybe are prone to make snap decisions about wanting to get in shape and so on. There's a squat challenge, for instance, that starts with 50 squats a day and ends with 250 squats a day. I don't know, Jennifer, if you've ever tried to do 250 squats in a day, but that is a lot, even if you've been doing them fairly regularly. So some of these are probably a little too lofty for non-exercisers to dive right into.
Are there any rewards for people who finish?
That's a great question. The Bikram Studio, for instance, offers discounts and guest passes to people who finish this 30-day challenge. Other people kind of set their own rewards. You know, maybe they say they're going to set aside some money and reward themselves with it at the end of the month or a certain treat. That's really the beauty of these. They really are very open-ended, and people can make of them whatever they want.
It's pretty cool. The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman with this weekend's Jennifer Koschinka. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. There's got to be a better way to mail and ship stuff because going to the post office takes up too much time. Leasing a postage meter is just way too expensive. Turns out there is a better way. Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer. You even get special postage discounts that you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at a fraction of the cost. You can save at least 50% compared to a postage meter, and you'll avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com, then enter the code Deal. Well, at this point, it's getting easier and easier to imagine a world in which cars do all the driving and we do none of it. Aaron Biba at Newsweek has a look at a technological innovation that could reinvent car culture. Aaron, what's going to happen?
Basically, what's going to start to happen with public transportation is it's going to be replaced by an industry of cars as a service. That's something that we're already starting to see a lot of now, but with people behind the wheel, you know, we have Uber, we have Lyft, you can walk out onto the street, you pull out your phone, you call a car, and somebody comes to pick you up. So in the future, you know, a lot of the experts are saying that those are just going to, you know, those are going to replace public transportation in a lot of places. So you no longer have fixed stops where you have to go find the subway station or find the bus stop. Just walk out onto the street, you call a car, and it's going to come and get you, and you don't have to worry about having a driver behind the wheel. So you don't have something that, you know, something that happened to me the other day was I was trying to get from San Francisco to Alameda. I called an Uber, and I got in the car, and the driver said, "That's too far. I'm not taking you. You have to get out." You know, the good news is with a driverless car, you don't have to worry about the human not wanting to take you where you want to go. We're still going to have subways. We're still going to have, you know, a lot of this infrastructure that already exists. but it's just going to be a lot easier to get around.
Yeah. All right. So you mentioned kind of this sharing economy here, and the one stat from somebody in your story had me thinking. He said, well, it's going to be the sharing economy. Cars are 95% of the time idle anyway, in which we don't use them. So what he's saying basically is now they can be used kind of 100% of the time, just maybe not by you.
Right, exactly. You know, it's going to, the driverless cars are going to really change our idea of ownership and car ownership. You know, who is the owner of the car? A lot of these services are going to, the services are going to own the car. The city will own the car, the service providers will own the car. So it's going to be a lot less usual to see an individual owning their own car. And that means that what you're going to have is maybe a family that normally would have on average a 2.5 cars are going to now maybe have one, if any at all. And, you know, you're just going to call the car to come get you when you need it. And when you don't need it, your car is just going to go off and do other stuff. Maybe drive other people around. Maybe it's going to deliver packages. It's going to take things from place to place. So your car is going to really just have a life of its own.
Wow. We're speaking with Erin Biba, contributor to Newsweek. She's got a piece called What the World Will Look Like Without Drivers. So on a more serious note, obviously, you point out drunk driving. Like, we just might not have those fatal wrecks anymore.
Well, all accidents are going to change. So the statistic nowadays is that 93%, and that is a huge number, of all accidents that happen on the road are due to human error. People get distracted, they panic, they misjudge their own abilities, they misjudge the abilities of others around them, or sometimes they're even just asleep. So if you think about it, if you remove humans completely from the equation, then that eliminates 93% of accidents. You don't have to worry about drunk drivers anymore, and you don't have to worry about the people around you just being stupid or making stupid decisions.
Right.
So you don't have accidents as much. Now, at the same time, that has a huge impact on the insurance industry. It's hard for us to say for sure exactly how that's going to affect the industry. It could just switch liability. So now you have the car manufacturers who are being insured and not the drivers or the owners. They're going to have the responsibility for the accidents. They're making the software that's controlling the cars. So if an accident happens in that car, it's the manufacturer's fault and not the human's fault anymore. But a lot of the insurance industry is thinking that they're going to maybe lose 60% of their premiums once humans are no longer making a ton of mistakes on the road.
Yeah. Thanks, Erin. Erin Biba at Newsweek. 21 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. The new survey finds that 62% of Americans rate their jobs as highly stressful, while just 11% felt their job stress is low. That said, what exactly is the cause of stress at work? Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast.com, is here with a deep dive on stressors. Kyle, what are they?
Well, the number one factor across all industries that people said was the most stressful was unpredictability, which I found very interesting. That's a change in your day-to-day workflow. You don't face a routine that you can kind of nail down, either because you face new projects, take on other people's work, or just the demands from dealing with clients or students if you're in academia or your bosses.
All right, so is unpredictability connected at all to, say, fear of losing a job, or is that a separate category?
No, that actually can be part of your fear of losing your job. You know, that competition within the workplace does factor into what we define as unpredictability for this survey.
Very good. All right, so what else was a factor here?
Deadlines is another one that came up really highly. Of course, anybody who's dealt with a strict deadline knows the pressure that can put on you 100%. And then in terms of some other industries, something like engineering and transportation were two where ensuring the safety of others ranked really highly. Healthcare, 50% of people who responded to our survey work in healthcare said ensuring the safety of others was their top stressor. So if you're working a field where you have to ensure people's safety for one reason or another, that's going to be the most prominent stress factor you face.
Gotcha. All right. So the stressors on the job, are they automatically connected to, say, your list of most stressful jobs, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, no. This is this survey that we ran is a little bit different from the jobs rated report, but this is to more get a sense of what our readers have to say based on what we do with our year-long kind of scientific study.
We're speaking with Kyle Kensing. He's online content editor at careercast.com, the jobs website. We're talking about what are the most stressful factors for people on the job. All right, so what else made the list?
Workplace environment was one that, depending on industry, ranked really highly. For example, in healthcare, that was about 11%. That's about 30% for customer service. And the fact that it jumped so much for customer service, not surprising, because you're dealing with a lot of different personalities in terms of customers that you're seeing. You have to kind of adapt your work style to either your fellow employee or the people that you're having to deal with. And that can be very stressful, especially if you're in something like customer service and people are maybe having a bad day and taking it out on you.
Yeah. I saw one, too, in the notes here, too, about the length of the work day or the length of the work week.
Yes, absolutely. That was one that didn't rank especially high in terms of where people voted that one. I think people are a little bit more accustomed to working longer hours or maybe having to work longer shifts. Now, in something like healthcare, that did get 5% of the vote. And if you work in something like nursing or if you're a doctor, you're going to put in very long hours, and that can be really challenging, really taxing.
Thanks, Kyle. Kyle Kensing, he's online content editor at careercast.com. 14 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. In seconds, a thief could steal your identity. Trying to restore your name and credit can take months or years. Damaged credit impacts everything. It can keep you from landing that great job or even getting a car loan. That's why I've got LifeLock Ultimate Plus Identity Theft Protection. LifeLock protects me in ways credit monitoring alone just can't. Watching out for my accounts, credit, and name. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock Ultimate Plus provides LifeLock's most comprehensive identity theft protection. I rest easier knowing my identity and life savings have LifeLock protection. Call or visit LifeLock.com now to experience the LifeLock identity theft protection that free credit monitoring can't give you. Use my promo code Gordon, promo code Gordon, and receive 10% off your membership at LifeLock.com. 800-916-7170. 800-916-7170. That's 800-916-7170. Valentine's Day is Sunday, as you probably know. Hopefully you made some kind of effort. That said, do the wrong gifts spell trouble for your relationship? We're joined now by psychologist Judith Wright, relationship expert, also co-author of a book with her husband called The Heart of the Fight, which came out this month. Dr. Wright, what about the wrong gift?
Well, because if you get the wrong gift, it might really symbolize that you don't know each other that well, that your partner doesn't really know what you need and you want, or that you're not communicating straight, or you're not telling each other what it is that you really desire. So it actually can indicate that there's some more work to do in your relationship.
All right. Certainly you've heard of a couple of examples of gifts gone wrong on Valentine's Day.
Well, you know, yeah, of course. So you're expecting, you know, a beautiful, you have this beautiful negligee you wanted, and your husband gets you an exercise machine or something, you know, which signals to you that there's something wrong with you, and it feels terrible. Or you wanted an engagement ring, a big one for many women, and you got roses. Or you did want a Fitbit, and he got you some dime store kinds of chocolates. You know, it depends on, you know, what you really wanted, and if it doesn't meet that, or if it feels like what you got just doesn't indicate that they know you at all. I mean, the big issue about it is that what that supposedly bad gift symbolizes so much, because it symbolizes that not only are you not known, it feels like, you know, you don't love me, you don't care about me, you really don't know who I am, and that's why they're so upsetting when they're not the right fit.
All right, so is there such thing as, say, a safe gift?
Well, I don't know if there's such thing as a safe gift, like a generic safe gift. I don't think so. But really, it's just, you know, what's the big deal about having a gift symbolized so much? I mean, I think that's part of the problem. We're making a gift or Valentine's Day be like this one big symbol of our love, and that's too much pressure on a gift and too much pressure on a day. We need to be communicating our care and affection and appreciation of each other all the time. We should have little treats for one another throughout the whole year. And then there's not so much pressure to go kaboom on this one gift or this one day.
Fair enough. All right, so how do you communicate to the other that, listen, hey, Valentine's Day, this is overblown. We don't need to get each other anything.
Well, that may not go over, but means a lot to your significant other. But to really talk about it, I mean, even before the day, you know, what are your expectations for that? What does it mean to you? What does Valentine's mean to you? What would make you feel loved and cherished and cared about? How do you want to spend the day? I mean, really to talk about it rather than to expect somebody to read your mind and instantly be able to meet your needs. And if there is something you need or want, to let your partner know that. I mean, so many women think, like, well, if he doesn't know and I have to tell him, that it doesn't count. It does, too, count. That's part of how we get to know one another. So the important things are really communicating, and, again, not just waiting for that day to be the big deal.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Judith Wright, relationship expert, also co-author of a book with her husband called The Heart of the Fight. Let's say you do get the wrong thing. You get the piece of exercise equipment. She assumes, oh, my butt must be big. Is that why you got this ring? So how do you turn that into a positive?
Well, you just kind of said it. You know, part of it is to be able to talk about it. You know what? That gift symbolizes to me that you think I'm overweight, my butt's too big, and that you don't love me and I'm not attractive. I mean, even starting to talk about the hurt and the disappointment and that what you really yearn for instead. If you can talk about that and get to what the pain is rather than just blame each other and fight about it, you can actually feel closer. And, you know, I also know couples where that has happened. They did talk it through, and then they did a do-over. They had a Valentine's Day that wasn't on February 14th. You know, they did a do-over. In fact, they did two. They did one do-over that was really just the way that she wanted it, and they did another do-over for the way that he wanted it. And they laugh about it. They had so much fun. They got closer because they used the opportunity rather than just to bear a grudge toward one another.
Dr. Judith Wright, the book is called The Heart of the Fight. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. During their downtime, NBA players typically watch TV, refresh Twitter, eat, sleep. But Chicago Bulls starters Pau Gasol and Nikola Mirotic would rather go to the opera or the symphony. The Wall Street Journal says around town they've become known as the city's biggest patrons of the arts. Gasol and Mirotic are regulars at the Opera House. They've even been backstage guests of the symphony orchestra. No one in the NBA, though, is as openly obsessed as the 35-year-old Gasol. He has seen or plans to see almost every opera in Chicago this season. This is a guy who keeps Mozart and Chopin recordings in his phone and thinks carefully before naming his favorite operas, Carmen, La Traviata, and Tosca, which he has seen three times. And here's a side issue, too. Almost no one who goes to the opera, right, is 7 feet tall. So the Lyric Opera and Chicago Symphony Orchestra go out of their way to make Gasol feel comfortable. He prefers sitting in a box, not because he's a snob, but because Gasol doesn't want to block anyone sitting behind him. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.